Welcome, everyone, to episode 7 of James Gordon Song and Rants Man, my monthly podcast where I explore different issues through commentary, conversation, and music. This is the second part of a 2-episode conversation about what I see as a crisis in the music business. My guests today are my neighbors here in Guelph, Liz Cazola and Braden Phelan, who perform together as the great roots duo Tragedy Ann, who are speaking from the perspective of young artists looking for ways to stay viable in these challenging times. And I've also got Heather Kitching, coming to us from Thunder Bay, who is the head goddess of the excellent online music publication Roots Music Canada. Since we are talking music, we'll start with a song. This is an old one of mine from the golden age of my band Tamarack back in the 80s, when conditions were much more favorable in the business. Then you'll hear me opining about the changes in the biz before I let our guests have the floor. This song's about small town prairie gigs, and it's rather creatively called Small Town Prairie Gigs.
Supper, jellied salads, casseroles, and hams. Their husbands would help us haul our gear out of that rusty old van. From the stage, you'd look out at the families in the crowd, such stories in their faces, weathered and proud. Sometimes we'd take their tales back home with us, and then time we'd come through, we'd be singing about them. When the show was over, cold cuts and coffee as they'd clear away the chairs. The local caller would show up and he'd holler, "Come on, John McNeil, all the good old tunes, Ukrainian polkas as they pop around the room. And we play them Chase Me Charlie as they dance the butterfly. Some of the old boys out the back sharing smokes and a little
at the places where you'd see the most tracks. A $1.99, make mine sunny side up. When the heater was working and the highways were dry, we were happy guys beneath that impossible sky. Here's a picture from way back with Doogie scraping hard on the film. Flat top and drummer on the skins in the middle. God, we looked so young, there were stars in our eyes. Took me all these years before I realized that back then when we figured someday we'd make it big, we could have never asked for better than those small town prairies. On the wheat fields, sparkling in the harvest moon's light. We'd be flying up the Yellowhead, the only ones on the road some nights. Some nights. Some nights.
I started in the biz over 40 years ago, when it was viable, like automatically. In fact, I'll ask you for, if you've shared this experience, Live in Braden. When I started out, this was in the 1970s, it was pretty typical. If I had a good night, I would come away with $100. And that was good because I actually have a song. I found one of your first albums that has a line in it that goes about my rent, which was $110 a month. So, okay. So the math worked, right?
I almost spat my tea out there.
I know. And now, 40 odd years later, because of rising costs and expenses, I feel like I have a good night if I come away with $100. Mm-hmm. Like now. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of why I sort of got alarmed. I think I've told each of you three that I did this tour in September, which was the first one I had done since before the pandemic. And I should have known this, but I think in that interim 4 years, expenses doubled and income was at least half. Do you think it's in crisis? And what are you noticing are the new challenges and changes? Does Tragedy Ann want to start with this? Oh, by the way, audience, I have with me Tragedy Ann and Heather Kitching. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. There.
Good. Okay. Take it away.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a big topic, and it's one that I feel like I sometimes push out of my mind in pursuit of well-being. And by that, it's like, If I can earn an income with other means, it puts the pressure off of myself as an artist to produce and to play more than I maybe my body is comfortable with. So that is something that kind of soothes this anxiety of the fact that the industry is in crisis. But it's not, it's kind of an avoidance strategy in some ways, because it's not actually, I mean, it's not like I can tackle it head on as one person.
Ultimately, it's a survival tactic.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
right?
For
because
sure.
The heart of the matter is that I think it is next to impossible or nearing impossible to make a steady and sustainable living from the music business in 2023. So rather than beating up against that wall and running into that wall again and again, and internalizing that and making, allowing it to make you think that we're at fault in that sense, like our art isn't good enough or we're not trying hard enough, all of those things that capitalism gets you to internalize, our response has been to kind of take a different route a little bit.
Yeah, when we first started recording music, it was at the very tail end of when CDs were something that audiences were buying. And so right. the first album that I released from the Lifers, we sold lots of CDs. And then the next album was significantly less, despite the fact that we could tell that the audience was more enthralled with it than the previous material. And it's all because things have come onto the streaming platform, which is problematic in a few ways, one of which is that we don't have the right legislation to make sure that the artists are actually earning the money from the audience's streams. As an environmental advocate, it's also not viable in the long run if you're going to be listening to the same album. I think it's less than 20 times it makes sense to stream it, but as soon as you have an, especially a favorite album, you're going to want to buy a physical copy, and that's going to be less of a carbon footprint as well. So that's kind of an aside, but there's a lot of layers of why streaming is a complicated issue these days. Another challenge that I feel that we face right now in the music industry is in the same breath as the opportunity, because we can be our own DIY artists by doing as much as we want in-house ourselves. So often we're our own booking agent, our own promoters, our own administrators, our own everything, which is such a beautiful freedom, but having to rely on that takes away from time as artists. And if there's not that kind of support from the venues or from the presenters, then it makes it a big undertaking to perform live music. So we've been really celebrating whenever we have engagements where there's some really significant support from the organization that we're partnering with. And that's just, you know, not always possible. There's only so many of those opportunities in Canada specifically. So that's my few cents, maybe 5 cents.
5 cents. Yeah. Well, before I dive into, I don't know, Braden, you want to have your 5 cents before I go to Heather, or are you a combined 5 cents?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would echo a lot of what Liv is saying. I think that the music industry, I try my best to differentiate between the music industry and the music community for a number of reasons, because I feel like the music community is something I very much value and love to associate with. The music industry is something I have more qualms with. I think that the industry and the community have been in crisis for a while. And I think that they're both subject to internal crises, but also the same crises that most folks are dealing with in perhaps a at times an amplified way. And that's not just because we use amplifiers. All of the things that the housing crisis, austerity, systemic racism, all of the things that are affecting individuals and organizations across the country and across the globe are also happening within the music industry, and those will manifest in different kinds of ways. But I do think that the age that we're in now, where it's just expected that most artists will be artist entrepreneurs, is a symptom of that austerity and shrinking of industries and shrinking of sectors in terms of there being viable income to be made.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I have to say, before I jump to you, Heather, when you have both told me that you sort of are avoiding the stress of diving all the way into the a perilous business by not relying entirely for your livelihood on it. As an old guy, that makes me sad. Yeah. And when I was at that conference where I saw all three of you, I was very inspired by the quality of the art being produced and the keen young people. It's really great for me as an older guy seeing that next generation come up. But I don't think I saw anybody in that hotel for the conference that was that had the expectation that they were going to make a livelihood from it. Mm-hmm. And part of me that rebels against that is someone that always has. I was 59 before I had any other paycheck besides the music business when I got elected to city council. And maybe that's why I'm noticing it more, because I got off city council and all of a sudden it's back to being my full livelihood. And I'm going, wait, this math doesn't work. Mm-hmm. What I see, and I see it in you wonderful people, if you've got another side hustle that's sucking up some of your energies and you are also being entrepreneurs too, how does that affect your creative output, which is so valued by a lot of people? So to me, I think you use the word avoidance to say live, but I'm more of a fighter. I go, damn it, these are great artists. They should be making a livelihood out of it. Let's find ways that they can. So it's an interesting paradox there. Heather, can you chip in now?
Sure. I mean, when you ask that question, you know, is the music industry in crisis? You know, I had to think about it from some different perspectives. I'm not 100% sure that it's in crisis for everybody, and I would be interested to hear other perspectives on this. For example, you know, if I were an Indigenous artist now, do I have more opportunities than I did back in the days when, you know, Willie Dunn was making records, for example? And I think the answer may be yes, but I'm not in a position to answer that question. So I don't want to speak in broad strokes about the entire music industry or even the entire folk scene, because I can only really speak from the position that I'm looking at it from. And so, you know, I had to think about, okay, well, what does it mean for the music industry to be in crisis? Because on one hand, you know, yes, we have a lot of, you know, artists out there who are not making money, but there were always a lot of artists out there who were not making money. So how do you figure out, like, you know, who should be making money in order to decide whether we're at a place where it's unjust? And I think that to me, it has to do with our artists being fairly compensated for the value of their work, their value being, you know, measured in how many people are listening to it and how many people are, you know, using it in restaurants and movies and all of those kinds of things. And I think that there are places where that compensation scheme still works, like in synchronization, and there are places where it doesn't, like in streaming. And I think streaming is particularly interesting because, you know, and I live in, and Braden, it's been years since I dealt with the royalty system, so help me out with this. Mm-hmm. If you get airplay on a national CBC program, what's the royalty rate that you get paid nowadays? Are you comfortable saying that?
Yeah. It's about $20.
Yeah.
Give or take it. Yeah.
Yeah. So you get $20. And, you know, the argument of the streaming services or those who negotiate the royalties on behalf of them is that, well, you get $20 for getting airplay on a national CBC program that might have a million listeners. And if you get a million streams on Spotify, you might actually get a little bit more than $20. So, you know, at 0.0003, you know, I don't know if I got the right number of zeros in there. But I think what it fails to take into account is the fundamental, you know, difference in the structure of the whole payment scheme. You know, getting played on a CBC program with a million listeners also came with a lot of publicity. Like the million people, of the million people listening, you know, probably only a relatively small number were fans of yours to begin with. but you gained a lot more fans out of that deal. And so essentially there was a promotional value that came back to you in exchange for that, you know, measly $20 that you got paid for that moment of airplay. You know, there was a give and take, and then that promotional value resulted in album sales if you were a artist of James's generation. And so, you know, it was a fundamentally kind of symbiotic relationship that these different pieces of the industry had to each other. You know, getting paid a fraction of a cent for a play on Spotify really doesn't contribute very much to the growth of your career. People are only going to find you on Spotify if they already know who you are, or if you're lucky enough to end up on a playlist or something. But I mean, the promotional value of being on Spotify is orders of magnitude smaller than what you get for being played on a radio program with, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of listeners. And so, you know, there's an argument to be made that people receiving royalties from Spotify should be, and other streaming services should be getting a lot more to compensate for the fact that it's taking away, you know, people who stream you on Spotify are, you know, kind of depriving you of, or Spotify is depriving you of promotional options. It's depriving you of sales. Mm-hmm. and you deserve, you know, compensation for the fact that if this is going to be the sole way that you get paid for creating recorded music, it has to actually pay, you know, a substantial sum of the costs of making that recorded music. And right now, it's not. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of talk about technological neutrality in copyright. And, you know, this idea that when you switch from one technology to another, the royalty regime should be flexible and should sort of, you know, result in the people who are exploiting work not sort of paying approximately the same amount to do the same thing, regardless of which technology they're using. So, mm-hmm. you know, there was debates, for example, about whether CBC should have to pay mechanical royalties to make copies of recorded material that for the sole purpose of just putting it into their computer so that it could get played on the radio. Mm-hmm. You know, the outcomes of those debates have been varied, and I'm not an expert on them, and there should really be a lawyer here, but I think that we really need to talk about technological neutrality when it comes to how it affects artists as well, which is that, you know, if Spotify is going to be the replacement for album sales and for promotion, then the royalty rate and the royalty system needs to adjust to actually compensate artists in a way that makes up for the loss of those other things.
I think streaming has changed the expectation of music consumers that they should be getting their music for free.
Yeah. Well, and I think in an ideal world, I would love to see everyone receive and enjoy art without financial barriers. I would love to see sure. music be free. But in that ideal world, artists would also be supported in a way
right.
that, you know, even ideally would not be tied to their output or their ability to produce in that kind of very mechanistic way. However, that's not the world we're living in. And mm-hmm. rather than it being a deliberate scheme to distribute music equitably, it's a deliberate scheme to distribute music exploitatively.
Right.
And I agree that it's hard. It's a hard sell when we talk to people about Spotify and about streaming, because from a listener's standpoint, it's amazing. You have almost all the music you could want for effectively for free. And you can listen to that, and unless you know otherwise, you can listen to it guilt-free. So to then say to someone, especially now that we're a couple decades into the online sphere of having music available that way, mm-hmm. To try and say to someone or remind them that someone is putting in time and effort and money into the creation and distribution of that art, and that perhaps that listener could play a part in compensating it, that can be an uphill battle or an uphill conversation.
An important thing to consider. I don't want this whole conversation to end up being about streaming, because it's just one part of this all. But the fact that the people profiting off of streaming are not the creators is the real issue here. So like, I would be very curious to see if there was some way that streaming services could be a part of the commons, and it was like a publicly funded nonprofit organization as opposed to a model of corporate greed. I think that things could change substantially. And of course, if there are some really good policies in place for royalty collection, that helps to, you know, redistribute that money as well. This is all making me also think about another reality in Canada, which is the granting system, which in some ways is really wonderful because you can get a lot of really great project funding, and it can really help to bring your visions to life. But it takes a lot of time to apply for these grants, and sometimes they can be seen as a means to survive instead of a means to create something that you really want to create. And so I guess kind of hinting at what you were hoping to get at later in the conversation, solutions-based thinking, I really do believe in the model of UBI mixed with some project funding, so that people don't feel the need to rely on project funding for operational and living expenses.
Right.
Tonight the crowd is smaller than a Canadian dollar. We're only getting paid the door, but the expenses are low, 'cause after the show we get to sleep on the club owner's floor. I know they call what we do playing, but it feels like work tonight. Nothing we do seems to make it through to the other side of the mics. Not another tune to carry. Jesus, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Isn't it time to go home? Not another tune to carry. Just don't get it. They raised the speed limit, but the town seemed farther apart. Though you're on it so often, the road never softens. It stays just as hard as my heart. The audience is older, the winter is colder, and it's been years since I was warm or young. Just how long can you sing a song for it is all sung? Not another tune to carry. Jesus, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Isn't it time to go home? Not another tune to carry. Jesus, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Isn't another beige motel, another meal from hell, another fun-filled tour. They never said the glamour was dead in the showbiz brochure. Too many guys with guitars, too many wannabe stars, so the money keeps getting worse. More and more, I have to dig deeper for words to the next verse. Not another tune to carry. does Curly mow and Larry? Isn't it time to go?
I mean, I think one thing, this is really more of a tangent than something directly picking up on what you and Liv and Braden were saying, but I think one thing I just wanted to mention is that, you know, I tend to use Spotify as like, you know, the example of all of the different streaming companies, but as Jeff Kulawick has pointed out, in a way, Spotify is probably the least of the offenders in the sense that, you know, first of all, Spotify was probably the company that came along first to break up the complete free file sharing system that had been created by Napster. Mm. So, you know, the streaming services did create an economy from something that had completely broken, and they created a framework that at least, you know, now allows for some negotiation over, okay, now we have competition, we can actually try and drive the fees up. Because really, you know, he points out that it's the technology companies like Google and Amazon. Google owns YouTube, Amazon owns Amazon Music. I mean, do we really want to be giving more power to them?
Yeah.
So I think I feel the need to point out that although I keep using Spotify as an example, they're not the worst. Yeah, they're not alone, and they're possibly not the worst.
Right.
And I think that for me at least is more disturbing than anything. If it's like, if we know how bad Spotify is, and then we remind ourselves as you are, that it's not the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting, like Spotify, you know, they took $200 million and bought Gimlet Media, which is a unionized podcast producer. So they're taking all this money from artists and then using it to pay union wages to other artists. And it's a really, you know,
it's confusing.
It's a complicated thing. But I think what it speaks to is the fact that, you know, these organizations have the funds to pay a lot better if they choose to.
But I do want to segue, because it was mentioned that the effect that the lack of merch sales and the rising costs of just costs of living, mm-hmm. can Liv and Braden, can you speak to the shifts, even in the time you've been doing it, to the viability of touring?
Sure. Well, one thing that I think can tie between what we were just talking about and that question is a conversation that I had a couple years ago now with James Keelahan, the artistic director for the Summer Folk Music Festival, where he was explaining that as merch sales have dried up, headlining acts at festivals have adjusted their fees and their rates to make up, to accommodate for that. To make up for
Sam mentioned that too last night. Yeah.
And so suddenly festivals and presenters are squeezed in that they're having to give more of their artists, their budget for artist fees to these headlining acts, and that leaves less money for smaller fish and particularly mm-hmm. young emerging artists, and it removes the ability for investment in the future of the community. And that we've felt that for sure, where there have been multiple times where, you know, there's an AD or a presenter who wants to have us on, but they just don't have the money in the budget for numerous reasons. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be budgetary restrictions. That's the water we swim in. But I think the last thing we need are more of those restrictions.
Right.
And James, you alluded to this in terms of overhead costs, but those are going up.
Sure.
Absolutely. So we did some touring in Europe this past summer, and rental cars were already off the rails.
And if you could even find one.
if you could even find one. And I booked our rental car, and I checked the next day, and it was twice. Just double the fee, and for no particular reason. And that's, you know, one anecdote, of course. Mm-hmm. Liv, you can probably speak to this.
Well, I wanted to speak to something that kind of touches on touring and recording, and the audience piece of this as well, because as we know, audiences are a huge part of the music industry. From a climate perspective, audience travel makes up the majority of the carbon emissions. And I feel like it's important to make sure audiences feel empowered and involved in these conversations, whether it be about climate or about the well-being of artists or whatever our songs are speaking to in a social change sense. The more we can call people in, the better. And one thing that Braden and I decided to try for our album release this spring was we ran a crowdfunding campaign. And in so doing, we really broke down like full financial transparency for those who wanted to participate in the crowdfunding campaign. And so we put together these little infographics that showed what we had to spend money on and what we expected to earn in different areas.
Liv says we, but it was entirely her who did the graphics. And she took great delight in doing
yes.
so.
Yep. I'm happy to be a nerd in that way. Spreadsheets and graphics are fun. But there were so many people who said to us, I had no idea that things would cost that amount. And I think that people felt really good to be involved in that part of the conversation. So we want to keep doing that going forward too. The more you can share, I feel in general in life with finances, with how your body feels, how your heart feels, the more we can just be very open with each other, the more understanding and compassion we can have as a community.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think particularly through social media, we can all take in and consume these warped views of what success looks like and how things are going for other people or how things are going for ourselves, when in fact we might be very much struggling or not being able to make ends meet. But that doesn't make for very good social media content necessarily.
Right.
Being more upfront about how we're really doing and dispelling the conflation between fame and success or number of Spotify streams and being able to make rent and all of that, I think is very, very important, and just being as transparent as possible for sure.
I really appreciate that comment about transparency, because I'm hearing from some folks in the biz the exact opposite, which is, we, in fact, it came up at that conference. I was speaking to someone there that said, everyone at this conference, a lot of them are pretending that everything's great because they don't want to be seen as struggling, which might negatively affect their opportunities that might be presented to them. And yet if the music consumers don't know, then that leads into my next question. They have to understand that it's a shared responsibility too. And when we know that all the costs are going up, one thing that has not gone up enough in the last 20 years is ticket prices. And yet, do you guys, everyone's struggling with their own budgets. Does the average music consumer have the capacity to meet the expectation that we now have as to what we need? It's the 25th anniversary of a musical play that I put on, and I was thinking of reviving it. And I looked at the posters and the ticket price was $25. and I thought, well, if I was putting it on again, that's probably all I could ask for now. And yet the costs are probably triple that. So,
yeah, well, this is making me think of sliding scale pricing, which whenever we can, we really like to offer sliding scale ticket pricing or pay what you can ticket pricing. The main reason why we like doing that is so that anyone who wants to come see us, you're welcome to come see us. That makes us feel really glad when it's not a barrier. But kind of, I feel like we could also put more effort into making sure that people who have the ability, financial ability, to be more patrons can actually be empowered to pay higher than the standard ticket price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a hard one to find solutions to, mm-hmm. I think, because it is something that ideally those ticket prices need to raise incrementally to match all of the costs and overhead that are going up in behind the scenes. I do think, though, that ticket prices have not stayed stagnant in every sector. When you think about Ticketmaster and the like, and the astronomical raising of ticket prices in that field.
In the 1%. Yeah.
In the 1%, exactly, because they can, and because people will pay for it. And I know I'm not the only one who's run the math on looking at a big stadium show and thinking, oh, how many local shows could I get for this one ticket price?
Right.
And of course, that machine is so much larger than anything we would present in here in Guelph, but the math still doesn't work out to me.
Yeah.
And I think that there is an education piece there necessary in terms of the value. I think that we all can agree that we value the arts, but that value doesn't translate into financial compensation or compensation much of any way.
Right.
But I know Buffy St. Marie talks about if you only knew activism. Mm. And I think that that's something that Liv and I have tried to tap into and embody when it comes to, you know, our financial transparency, for example, and talking about streaming services and doing sliding scale tickets as well, because every now and then you'll have people ask about that.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, this may be a tangent too, but another thing that the success of the 1% has had a negative impact on is, and I noticed this even when, especially I used to have a side career doing kids shows. But when the 1% is able to put on a show where a helicopter lands on stage and they have fireworks behind you and it's a big production, there's less inclination for someone to go into a club and watching a guy with an acoustic guitar singing into a microphone. So there's a re-education that way, because that's my preference, but it's stiff competition. Heather, have you got something to chip in there?
I mean, I think that overall, like, you know, my feeling about this, like, I am sympathetic to the desire to educate people about the true value of music and what it actually costs to record and tour and that kind of thing, and to try and encourage people to compensate artists willingly at the rate that they actually need to be compensated at if they're going to continue to make a living making music. But at the end of the day, I feel like, you know, like everybody's in the same boat in the sense that, you know, people are streaming music because they can't afford to buy records, because they, you know, are getting paid minimum wage because they're also employed by the 1%.
Right.
And so I think that there's, you know, fundamentally as a music community and as a larger community, you know, it's like, there's a bigger question. Like, I don't think the solution is just going back to the way it was,
right?
Because that would involve, you know, putting everything, you know, turning capitalism back to pre-1980s levels. And I don't think we have the capacity as a music community to do that. So I think it, you know, the solutions are really in how do we take what's left of our resources and try to, I don't know whether it's finding ways to operate outside of capitalism or whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, being part of the socialist revolution. I don't know, but mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is, I feel like, you know, anything that we come up with, I mean, I think there's value in education. There's definitely value in asking people who can to contribute more. But in some ways, you know, every time we do that, and I'm guilty of it too with Roots Music Canada, I mean, you know, we're essentially just sort of, you know, asking our own progressive socialist minded communities to sort of behave in socialist ways, even though they're being squeezed as much as everybody else is by capitalism. And I feel like, you know, somehow we need to figure out something that's more sustainable, because everybody is gradually getting less and less and less of the pie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
You're touching on such an important thing there, Heather, where it's, this is actually just one piece of the puzzle of a larger conversation. Mm-hmm. And the solutions that are going to benefit musicians are also, I hope, going to be the solutions that help make housing more equitable and make sure that the world becomes anti-racist, and, you know, all of these layers and layers of social justice that we really want to speak to as musicians and we know need to change.
Yeah. I feel hope when I think about, you mentioned, Heather, our remaining resources. And I think in the physical sense, I can resonate with that. But then I also think about how it is incredibly hard, I think, to create scarcity out of human creativity. I think that that is a very swiftly and aggressively replenishing resource. And I do think about, there is more music being created and listened to now than ever. And that I'm very excited about. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that technology is inherently a villain here, because I think it is creating, I mean, the fact that we're able to be creating a broadcast right now,
right,
you know, with technology that we all have in our own homes, and get this story and these voices out is moving to me and fills me with optimism. We just need to find ways to disconnect it from that bigger machine.
Hmm. That's good. Yeah. So you actually already answered that. Maybe the last question I was going to ask about, it looks like you're finding ways, Braden, to hold hope for what lies ahead. And that's a sincere thing. And as long as you can do that, then maybe that's the way forward, to look for different ways. Instead of, I too often fall into the slough of despond when I go back to that default for me. Well, geez, it always worked before. Why doesn't it work now? So for those of you who haven't even experienced that golden age, maybe there's another golden age that can happen if we kick out the jams of capitalism and try new systems in some ways. But I don't know if Liv and Heather, you want to comment on where do you hold that hope, if you do?
Sometimes I don't, sometimes I do.
Yeah.
But I feel like hope and love are kind of one and the same. And when I can sing with other people,
right,
I feel those things. And so I think engaging with what it is about music that brings joy, whether it's as a musician, as an audience member, as an arts administrator, no matter what it is, as long as we're connecting to the joy and the love of it, I think that's hopeful.
Hmm.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think, like, I'm also older, so I remember some of the golden age, and I think in some ways, you know, maybe it's easier for young people to be more hopeful because they don't have the same, like, length of trajectory to, you know, like, to have seen how bad it's gotten compared with, you know, some of the days that we remember. So yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have a lot of hope. Like, I suppose I hope that, you know, we'll figure something out. And I, you know, I definitely feel, you know, hope or happiness within the context of, you know, an artistic community and in the context of doing some of my own creative work, which isn't musical, but this is more documentary and that kind of thing. I take a lot of, I know for me, like choosing to pursue a more creative path later in life, I take a lot of inspiration from the artists that I've worked with over the years. And, you know, because, I mean, let's face it, being an artist has never been the easiest career. It's always filled with indignities, as your lengthy list of stories, James, has demonstrated. So I think that, you know, I feel a sense of community and connection with people who are struggling to be creative in spite of the odds that everybody faces. And I hope that, you know, somewhere in there, we just find a way to keep doing it, you know, despite all of the pressures from outside.
Well, that's a
and
great...
And maybe inspire other people to live better.
That's a great wrap-up takeaway, because one of the reasons I asked you, Heather, to take part is that I know you as a nurturer of the music community in the work that you're currently doing. And as both Liv and Braden have said, just that connection and community, to me, that's what's gonna get us through, if indeed we can get through. And that doesn't apply just to the music business. That applies to everything too. Tragedy Ann, thank you for your role today. Have you thought of a tune you'd like to share with us, or should I pick one?
Especially given the tone that we left off on, our song "I Hope This Finds You Well" might be a good
song. Yeah.
I hope this finds you well. On the day you hear the calling, and that your heart rings like a wedding bell, I hope this finds you well. Gently may you go when the trees and the leaves are fallen. May you find your peace in a campfire glow. Gently may you go, my friend, your show. They'll forever be applauding. If your song is shared, then you're never gone. My friend, your show goes on. And may your skies be blue wherever wings may take you. At dawn you'll see every point of view. May your skies be blue.
Grateful to you both for this.
Thank you, James.
That's it. That's all for now, folks. Thanks for listening. If you want to know more about Tragedy Ann and their excellent music, check them out at tragedyannmusic.com. That's Ann without an E. And Roots Music Canada can be found at rootsmusic.ca. You can find my music and info at jamesgordon.ca. And since we've been talking about ways to stay afloat for musicians, if you found value in listening to this podcast, I gratefully and humbly accept contributions through PayPal or by e-transfer to james@jamesgordon.ca. See you next time on James Gordon, Song and Rants Man, and please spread the word.